This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices, episode 350, was produced on November 17th, 2022. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy and a one-stop shop for all green energy investors. Simplify Asset Management Chief Strategist and Portfolio Manager Mike Green returns as this week's feature interview guest. Mike was the first person to tell me, almost 2 years ago now, that World War III had already begun. Now, to be clear, Mike's not talking about nuclear Armageddon. He's talking about a growing conflict between Russia, the United States, and China, which won't look anything like World War II. This interview will focus on the economic and trading implications of this new war cycle. This is another long interview, a full hour, but I think you'll find it very much worth your time. Our production schedule will be adjusted next week for the American Thanksgiving holiday. With markets closed on Thursday, our tentative plan is to release the podcast late Wednesday evening. But please bear with us if that plan changes. Our production team has travel plans for the holidays, and there's always a chance we could have to rejuggle the schedule at the last minute due to logistic constraints.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Listeners, be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after Eric's feature interview with Mike Green, when Eric, Nick, and I discuss the post-election and post-inflation number market trends and what's next for the S&P 500, NASDAQ, oil, gold, uranium, and treasury bonds. Now, Eric, before we move on to our feature interview with Mike Green, let's cover crude oil, starting with those EIA inventory.
EIA printed a headline number of a massive 5.4 million barrel drawdown, but put your seatbelt on, it was really a 9.5 million barrel drawdown after you include the 4.1 million barrels drawn out of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. Now, some people have said to me, hey, why are you including those SPR draws? You know, they're not technically part of the headline number. Look, this is what is being drawn out of inventories due to consumption, and we can't continue draining the SPR forever. There's only about 150 million barrels left in the SPR before we get down to the statutory minimum level that it's required to maintain. So even if President Biden continues with more SPR releases into the new year, eventually we're going to run out. Cushing, Oklahoma, drawing down 1.6 million barrels that we can't afford to lose. The builds on the board were in finished products, with gasoline building 2.2 million barrels and distillates building 1.1 million barrels. U.S. production unchanged at 12.1 million barrels. Tape action after inventory was a dip below the 55-day moving average to the lowest print since the 25th of October. The market then recovered to close back above the 55-day moving average, but then overnight in Asian and European trading fell to even lower lows, back down to just over $83. I'm recording before the U.S. open on Thursday morning, so it'll be very interesting to see what Thursday brings. It's been a roller coaster week of fundamental drivers. We started with a rally on more China, let's call it not reopening news, but a hint that maybe reopening was coming. It was news about relaxed quarantine requirements for crossing the border into China. That seemed to spur a certain amount of speculation that maybe there really was a move afoot to reopen the economy, but that didn't last. The big slam down came with Janet Yellen confirming in her comments at the G20 in Bali that essentially what everybody's been saying really since she announced her price cap that it wasn't going to work was right, that it's not going to work. She's now claiming that the fact that China is obviously going to buy up whatever oil is not going to Europe is part of their plan, supposedly. And they figure that it's going to give China more negotiating power to get lower prices and keep that oil in the market in order to provide supply while forcing prices lower. Sounds to me like she's just saving face after her plan has been shown to be nonsense. But one way or another, it was the catalyst for a big move down in prices. The other thing that came just shortly thereafter was OPEC revising its demand projections for Q4 of this year substantially lower. Now, everybody looks at that as, okay, lower demand, that's got to mean lower prices. Stop and consider the source. If OPEC is revising its demand projections lower, that sounds to me like maybe they're paving the way to announce even more production cuts beyond what's already been announced. So it's certainly going to be interesting to see what the next OPEC Plus meeting brings. Then the big, huge move up came when it was reported that a Russian missile had landed in Poland. In reality, it was a Ukrainian missile that landed in Poland, but the Polish president immediately blamed Russia and the media without the slightest shred of validation or critical analysis reported that as fact with no verification whatsoever. And it's shocking, frankly, the amount of Russia did it propaganda which continued, despite the fact that photo evidence had been widely circulated on the internet showing that the missile which landed in Poland was actually a Ukrainian-fired 5V-55 series S-300 anti-aircraft missile. They're still talking about imposing Article 4. Needless to say, the news when it was supposedly a Russian missile caused the market to go straight up, and as it was debunked and proved to be a Ukrainian missile, that brought the market straight back down, and we've seen a further deterioration from there. So the uptrend that had been in place in this market has clearly been broken. It looks to me, given the trading that I'm seeing before the U.S. market opens on Thursday, like if the current support level doesn't hold, we're really going back to the lows established on the 18th of October, which were right around 81.35. It remains clear to me that China reopening will be the trigger for much higher oil prices, but it's equally clear that it's not happening yet. And I think what we're seeing here in this tape action is a little bit of boy that cried wolf phenomenon, where there have been a few rumors that seemed like they were indicating a China reopening announcement was coming. No actual confirmation happened, and now the market just doesn't want to believe it. But what I find most interesting is that even in the face of an incredibly weak dollar, with the U.S. dollar index down dramatically this week, the market really had no reaction to that massive, what really was a 9.5 million barrel drawdown on inventory, 5.4 in the headline number, plus what came out of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, adding up to 9.5 million barrels. That's a massive drawdown. It shows that we really do have a very tight physical market. The IEA, meanwhile, reported the lowest global inventories of crude oil since 2004. And just for context, remember, that would be in the immediate wake of the 2003 Iraq invasion, where obviously there was massive supply destruction as a result of that invasion. Meanwhile, EU sanctions take effect in about 2.5 weeks. As I've said before, I don't think they're going to take much, if any, oil off of the market, although a lot of people disagree with me on that. And China's reopening might be around the corner, but absent any announcement of that, it looks to me like oil prices are headed still lower. Why is that? I think it's probably because a lot of funds are starting to short oil on speculation that a global recession is going to take the crude oil market much lower. And that's entirely possible. Remember, my thesis here is that the world cannot get back to pre-pandemic normal. That's not global recession. That's pre-pandemic normal because we don't have enough energy supply. We certainly do have enough energy supply to supply a muted need for energy in a global recession. So if the global recession happens before the China reopening, it could be that the whole phenomena of a massive global energy crisis could be delayed until after that global recession comes to an end. So it's possible that that whole higher price scenario that I've described could be put on hold for potentially the duration of the recession if the recession really starts in earnest before China's reopening.
This week's feature interview guest is Simplify Asset Management Chief Strategist and Portfolio Manager, Mike Green. Eric, why did we invite Mike back as a guest this week?
Mike was the first guy to tell me that World War III had already begun. That was almost 2 years ago. Now, I conflated that to mean that Mike was predicting nuclear Armageddon, and frankly, I thought he was off his rocker. I didn't listen. That was my loss. He really was on to something. He did see something coming that was incredibly important, and because I read too much meaning into those words, World War III, I wasn't paying attention as much as I should. So I want to encourage our listeners, don't be thrown off by that terminology. He's not talking about nuclear Armageddon. He's talking about a conflict between China, Russia, and the United States, which is really going to change everything. It's going to be a major game changer for the economy, markets, and geopolitics. So I wanted to get Mike back on the show to talk about the market and economic implications of this new war cycle.
Eric's interview with Mike Green is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
If you invest to bring about a world powered by green energy, you should meet Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy that serves as a one-stop shop for green energy investors in Europe. Respect Energy brings together independent power producers, accredited and institutional investors holding assets in renewables or undertaking investments in new green energy production, such as wind and solar photovoltaic power plants. More than 600 institutional and accredited investors have already entrusted Respect Energy with the sale of their electricity production, portfolio management, O&M services, EPC, and project development. If you want to invest in green energy in Europe with the help of a trusted partner, contact Respect Energy today and ask for a tailor-made solution. For more information, visit respect.energy.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Mike Green, Chief Strategist and Portfolio Manager for Simplify Asset Management. Mike, it's great to get you on the show. I want to dive right in because it was, boy, next month, I think, or in January, it will have been 2 years since you first told me off the air in a private phone call that World War III had begun a year prior to that. And at the time, I have to admit, I was completely dismissive. I thought you were off your rocker. But in hindsight, what I recognize is the reason I wasn't listening, as I should have been, is the phrase World War III, to me, really equated to certain and impending imminent nuclear Armageddon. And I thought you were crazy to think that. That's not really what you thought. That's not what you meant. So let's start by clarifying, what did you mean when you told me almost 2 years ago now that a major new war cycle had begun?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me back. And your initial assessment that perhaps I am off my rocker was the right one. But what I meant by World War III was effectively we were moving into a regime in which the frenemy coopetition dynamic between China and the United States in particular had degenerated and had really begun to degenerate starting in 2013 into a next phase of competition where we were really focused on effectively carving up the rest of the world into spheres of influence, and that we were going to engage in a series of competitive trading dynamics, competitive financial market manipulation dynamics, and proxy wars that could, under bad circumstances, escalate out of the Cold War-type framework that we were familiar with the Soviet Union, and potentially turn hot. Now, unfortunately, I think that as time has passed, things have gotten hotter. And the question now is, can we avoid an escalation that takes it, much further? But it does, I think most people would acknowledge, as you kind of have, that we've begun to very clearly move into a competitive mode that often involves degrees of violence that feels very different than the coopetition that we were engaged in for, the better part of 30 years following the fall of the Soviet Union.
Okay, so we know that what it's not, when we talk about this new war cycle, is impending nuclear Armageddon. We're not talking about that. But I think we're also not talking about the same thing as the Soviet-American Cold War that lasted for decades. We're not talking about the same thing as World War II, where, you know, soldiers in trenches and tear gas or mustard gas, whatever it was. What are we talking about? What are the dimensions that we should expect to this ongoing war? It sounds like it's kind of not the same as a Cold War because it's a little hotter than that. We've already got proxy wars going, at least with the situation between U.S. and Russia. It seems to me that the war in Ukraine has been escalated in some respects to reflect a tension between U.S. and Russia as opposed to just the Russia-Ukraine situation. Certainly, the United States has pledged much, much, much more money to the Ukraine defense than any other country has. So it's not a Cold War. It's not really a hot war yet. It seems like it's more than just a proxy war. Is there something else? Should we think about Vietnam as to what this is supposed to look like? How do we know what's coming?
Well, I would describe that what's happening in Ukraine between the United States and Russia is not even so much about Ukraine or Russia, for that matter, as much as it is about the U.S. reasserting its control over Europe. Right. And so what we've seen throughout the last decade is Europe, particularly in the form of Germany, has flirted with Eastern alliances. Right. Do we integrate ourselves more closely with Russia? You know, the leaders of Germany have, with a disturbing degree of regularity, become significant financial figures in the Russian sphere of influence. And the relationship, obviously, between Germany and China had superseded, from a trading standpoint, the relationship between the United States and Germany. And I would largely argue that what we've experienced over the last year, and really kind of over the last 7 years in some ways with the original invasion of Ukraine, has largely been a function of the U.S. trying to reassert control over Europe, making it, again, energy dependent on us. In many ways, what we're engaged with in Europe is a lot like a lend-lease program, where we are now driving Europe increasingly into a debtor relationship with the United States, where their access to food, their access to energy, fertilizers, et cetera, increasingly depends on our willingness to export it to them. That to me feels like a much more accurate description than a simple competition between Russia and the United States. It feels very much about separating Europe from the sphere of Eastern influence.
Well, Mike, I want to credit you, because you definitely saw this coming before anyone else that I know. I would think that probably qualifies you to have some insight as to who's behind it and what the motive was, because it seems to me, you know, you said we're moving from a trend of friendly competition into, you know, borderline hot wars here. Why did we, who wanted to make that change? It doesn't seem like a very friendly thing to do. Who's behind this? What's their motive? Why did they want to escalate friendly competition to proxy wars?
I think that there are multiple players behind it, right? I mean, we went through something very similar, like the relationship that we currently have with China, with Japan, in the mid to late 1980s. And it was ultimately resolved in a manner that I think that we're trying to get a resolution in Europe, again, where effectively Japan rolled over and said, fine, we will remain, instead of being in competition with the United States or trying to become a rival, right, as Japan is number one, we're going to accede to trade limitations, we are going to bend over on the auto exports, we're going to increasingly integrate ourselves with the United States, functionally making ourselves a tributary to the United States in perpetuity. My guess is that while I highly doubt that people are expressing it at the highest levels in exactly this term, that's largely how we're trying to restore the relationship or reintegrate the relationship with China. We will not accept them competing with us in the way that they appear to want to compete, and that became very clear under Xi starting in 2013 that they were prepared to do. And as a result, we ultimately have to create conditions under which they fold in a manner similar to the Japanese. They just might be a lot more difficult to get to fold in that manner. They might be willing to institute much worse hardships on their population. And that's really going to be the unknown, is, you know, who ends up being able to bear the pain the greatest. Is there sufficient pain for the United States to cause it to rethink this process? It, you know, one of the real challenges, I would argue, is that as much chaos as we may feel with a bond market down 20% and a stock market down, you know, 25% or a NASDAQ down 25% in the US, we're really not experiencing any pain while there's fairly significant pain going on around the rest of the world. If you were to, you know, frame this in a similar fashion and look at the 1920s, for example, as an analog, I would argue that there's a lot of similarities where the US really has not in any way yet suffered. You can go to, you know, you can go to Europe and experience fairly significant hardship, fairly significant sacrifices that are being made where businesses are failing and being nationalized in order to keep their energy flow independent and on, right? Effectively, governments are nationalizing things like the energy firms in Germany, precisely to be able to continue to finance them, right? These businesses independently wouldn't be able to access the credit required to make the purchases that are necessary. So, you know, this feels to me like we're moving towards the same sort of framework that actually characterized the 1930s, where the U.S. functionally forced the multinational corporations and multinational individuals, right? The elites who were able to travel around the world and pretend that they were citizens of the world. We force them to choose. Are you going to be Americans or are you going to be internationalists? And if you're going to be internationalists, there's going to be substantive penalties associated with that, everything ranging from loss of economic freedoms to potentially loss of your businesses. And we are moving towards, we've tried to push, I would argue, China and Russia into something very similar to what we saw with Germany and Russia in the 1930s, the Molotov-Ribbentrop Protocol, where, you know, two relatively weak individual players are forced to collaborate, hoping that they can, you know, reclaim effectively a degree of independence and autarky that they can't do individually. Now, I think the odds and the prospect of that are quite low, but that doesn't mean they're not going to try, right? There's an incredible incentive.
I want to make sure I understand this analogy to the 20s with respect to what comes next, because as you say, the 20s were party times in the United States. Everything was fine. But then came the 30s and the early 40s, which was anything but a happy time in the United States. So are you saying this is the calm before the storm and it's going to get much, much worse domestically in the United States? Or are you saying we're insulated and we're not going to experience the effects of this conflict?
I think, unfortunately, we have a choice. Right. And I would argue that this is one of the reasons why I'm so vociferously opposed to what the Federal Reserve is doing. Right. I think the Federal Reserve is moving to address an inflation that can much more easily be explained by supply disruptions than by a monetary phenomenon. They're attempting to address it with monetary solutions that are causing the US dollar to skyrocket around the world and leading to conditions under which you could have a seriously coordinated global recession. I've pointed people to listen to my good friend Alex Gurevich, who was on your program a couple of weeks ago. And Alex and I think Alex and I see this very similarly in that the dynamics of inflation really haven't been monetary in their nature. And I know that's frustrating to people, and I'm not suggesting that there hasn't been significant amounts of intervention on the monetary policy side, but the inflation that we've experienced has largely been a byproduct of an incredible amount of stimulus that was pumped out into the US economy while supply chains were largely shut. And the challenges of reopening those supply chains are very similar to the experiences we had post-World War I and again post-World War II. In both situations, we recognized that we needed to reorient and reconstruct the US economy. And therefore, we didn't hike interest rates and shut off capital formation. This time around, we've decided to respond to a very real signal that requires the US to make very substantive investments in terms of changing our output structure, forcing us to become more energy independent, to make investments in energy, to make investments in industrial production, to make investments in infrastructure. And our reaction to that by hiking the cost of capital so dramatically means that none of that is happening, or far less of it is happening than otherwise would. That policy feels like just a terrible mistake in the context of what we're experiencing. And Alex candidly introduced the idea, and it's one that I would unfortunately support, that this could very well turn into a much less stable situation than we think. And that is, unfortunately, what the 1930s were, right? It was a period of such intense uncertainty that you only would actually do something from a business investment standpoint, basically, if you were guaranteed by the government that you would be made whole. Like that's, you know, that this is the Russell Napier story about fiscal dominance and a government-driven investment spending boom. This is the same narrative, I would argue, that Alex is highlighting when he says what we've experienced so far, you know, is not the the slowing down of inflation that we're seeing right now. This has almost nothing to do with Fed policy. Fed policy is not going to hit for a couple more years. You know, the unwinding of the explosive increase in home prices, durable goods, et cetera, those are largely predictable simply on a basis of the unwind of the dynamics of the pandemic. Now the Fed is complicating that and exacerbating those conditions. And that candidly is a little terrifying to me and does look very much like the liquidate stocks, liquidate labor framework that led us into the Great Depression.
Okay, I really want to understand this one, Mike, because until this conversation, I've been thinking about this war cycle. Is okay, as much as the deflationists had made a good argument, they must have it wrong because wars always tend to be inflationary. I thought that this war and the geopolitical escalations that we're seeing were likely to be confirmations that we're really in a secular inflation. It sounds like what you're saying is no, it really is the case that the Fed stimulus and reaction to the pandemic is what got this whiff of inflation going. But it sounds like you would agree with what I assume is still Alex Gurevich's view, which is this is ultimately headed toward a really serious deflation and potentially into depression. Is that right?
Unfortunately, I think that, I mean, look, I think anytime you say something along those lines, you have to put an element of, you know, uncertainty into it, right? Like, there's no way to know that the great, you know, the next Great Depression is coming for the very simple reason that I don't have all of the information available to me that would be necessary to predict that. And I also don't know what other people will change in their reactions to the mere post, you know, positing of that hypothesis, right? But the simple reality is that we're engaged in the same type of collateral destruction that leads credit systems to implode. Right? We all can see the stress that is beginning to emerge in the corporate sector, particularly amongst the heavily levered entities. We can see the stress beginning to emerge in the household sector, particularly against those who are significantly exposed to the housing component. And we're seeing the underlying characteristics of an economy in which people are deeply unhappy, despite the fact that supposedly everybody has jobs and there's tons of opportunity for people to upgrade and move into new, you know, into new roles. Like it just, the circle doesn't square is the easiest way to frame that. And as a result, you have to consider alternatives. You know, your idea of the underlying inflationary dynamic, I agree with you that in terms of relative prices, at least on a short-term basis, we're likely to see much higher energy prices. We're likely to see much higher, you know, quote-unquote rare earths, right? And let's just remember what rare earths are. It's not that they're particularly rare. It's that they are rare relative to dirt, right? And as a result, they're expensive and dirty to process. We just don't like to do it. We'd rather put the waste and environmental pollution elsewhere. But for national security reasons, increasingly we're being forced to confront the reality that we're going to have to do some of those things on our shores, right? And that requires a reorientation and a rejiggering of U.S. society that gets people to do some of these things that we just don't want to do right now, right? That unfortunately is what really rough economic times mean. It means people are forced to make choices that are suboptimal versus where they are today.
With respect to that reshoring of critical industries, the way I've been thinking about this is, look, the whole globalization trend, what was the driver behind it? It was the exploitation of cheap overseas labor. So if for national security reasons, you're going to say, okay, we can't buy all the cheap stuff from China anymore if we're potentially going to risk going to war with China, we need to get that back in the U.S. Well, maybe that's the right decision, but it's got to be much more expensive to do that. I would think that's a really strong secular inflation driver, isn't it?
Well, again, it, you know, the definition of inflation is an increase in the general price level, right? So it is, you know, M going up, and therefore P rising as Q does not respond and velocity stays constant in the MV equals PQ equation, right? What we know is that when we raise M, velocity falls. And so the question of, is this a monetary inflation is very different. What we saw this time around was we saw the government support demand for actual products and services, despite the fact that the supply of them was relatively limited. So we drew down inventories and then had to deal with the bullwhip effect as it worked its way through the system, importing tons of stuff through our ports that are not prepared for the surge of goods, et cetera. So, you know, I fight against this idea that this is quote unquote inflation if it's a relative price signal that says this gets more expensive and therefore you need to devote more of your budget to it, making sacrifices elsewhere, right? That's a shift in relative prices that tells you something about future consumption and future investment opportunities. So it is not like as frustrating as it sounds to people. And, you know, my partner, Harley Bassman, I drive him crazy with this, but it is unfortunately very true that it means something very different if you say the price of raw materials is going to go up relative to the price of dinner at Applebee's. Like that's a very important distinction.
It seems to me like an even more important distinction is that last time we went through this in the 1920s and 30s, the United States was a creditor nation. The United States is now the biggest debtor nation in the history of the world. It's a completely different debt dynamic. And you're talking about something happening which is going to have profound impacts on credit markets. So how would this time be different from last time, considering that our starting point is massive indebtedness, both at a national level and also households are much more indebted than they used to be?
So part of the dynamic behind indebtedness, right, remember, is a function of just maturity. So all debt is somebody else's asset. And when you talk about the dynamics of surplus, it allows me to capitalize all sorts of things that I otherwise couldn't, right? If I'm living hand to mouth, my prospect of taking on debt to finance a purchase, which I'm going to need to reduce future consumption relative to my productive capability in order to pay back that debt, right? You know, I can't do that if I'm absolutely at subsistence levels. And so a wealthier society, almost by definition, is going to become a more indebted society. The second component is when you talk about the indebtedness of the United States, and this I realize feels like a very false distinction to people, but in the 1930s, remember, we had an obligation to meet our debt in the form of gold. Today, we don't have that convertibility, and we fully defaulted on that in the 1930s, despite all the components that you're highlighting, right? That we were actually the world's creditor nation. Why did that fall apart for us? Very simply because the collateral that we had underpinned all that debt with fell apart. Right, that was actually the lead-in into the 1930s Great Depression, where things like the collapse of German bonds or Russian bonds that had been held by U.S. investors and Western investors, as those businesses effectively had to be written off and written down, the overall collateral in a credit-based system collapsed into something that had, you know, a very specific deliverable in the form of gold, and we had to default against that. Have we done something similar? Are we likely to do something similar in real terms? Sure, that could certainly happen. Will we see ourselves print money in response to various events that could lead to significantly higher prices or a higher general price level? Absolutely. Could we see us decide that we need to reorient our society to produce, you know, to produce the goods and services that we want to consume closer to shore? Again, like it does feel like that's the right answer, but that is, you know, getting there is a function of making hard choices in our society. And so far, it feels like our bias is just not to make those hard choices yet. Again, speaking to the need for economic discomfort, and I hate this. I don't actually think that it's necessary. I think we're making poor choices that exacerbate it. But we don't have to make those choices in the way that we're choosing to make them, but we are making these choices.
What's not adding up for me mentally right now as I'm processing all this is it seems like on one hand, if I take, you know, Ben Bernanke's explanation, at least as I've struggled to understand it, has been the cause of the Great Depression was the gold standard. And if we had had the fiat money system that we have now, there wouldn't have been a problem. Well, presumably what that means is it would have allowed the government to respond by printing money like it's going out of style in order to paper over our problems, which it seems to me would be just profoundly inflationary, and that may have actually been the goal. But you and Alex are both talking about deflationary outcomes. So what am I missing here?
Well, again, it just becomes a question of against what? Right. So, yes, that would have been profoundly inflationary in the Great Depression, which might have meant that the price level stayed stable. Right. So when Alex and I say that this is deflationary and we say that money printing is likely to return in one form or another to offset those risks, it's not because we're actually saying the objective is to get the price of copper to $10 a pound. The objective is actually to keep prices at a relatively constant level in what is likely to be a severe economic shock, right? What I would argue people are largely forgetting as they start talking about things like copper, right, non-ferrous metals and the electrification of the future, et cetera, is remember places like China consume 50% of the world's copper in their housing markets, in their plumbing markets, in their electrical infrastructure market, et cetera. Much of the commodity boom that we saw from the period of 2000 roughly until the period of 2012 was a function of China reindustrializing and putting itself in a position to have the infrastructure to service the needs of the West. Now you're talking about places like China actually facing contracting populations and a loss, a significant loss of market share in the global export space. And almost certainly that is likely to lead to them turning around and mining effectively their own copper supplies in the form of tearing down buildings or tearing down unnecessary infrastructure and re-liquefying a lot of those supplies, right? So I can create a story that says, yes, the price of goods assembled and manufactured in China go up at the exact same time, right? Because we're replacing them with more expensive labor elsewhere in the world, although I do think that technology can play an important role there. But at the same time, like the price of copper could very well fall under those conditions. The price of iron could actually fall significantly. The price of cement or fuel could fall fairly significantly under those types of conditions.
Okay, now I'll hit you with the biggest challenge, Mike. Let's translate this to implications for markets. I want you to imagine you're speaking to an audience of professional portfolio managers. You've just told them that the price of just about everything could go dramatically up or dramatically down. So what trades do you recommend in that environment?
So this is actually one of the things that I would highlight, and I appreciate the way that you said that. It could go dramatically up or it could go dramatically down. I don't know what the right level is. Right. And I'll just lay that out there as simply as possible. There's too many pieces that are moving. So when you're in that type of position, and this is, you know, something that I've spent a lot of time talking about recently, is you basically want to use strategies like trend following to allow the market to guide you in that direction. Right. I don't know the right price for copper. I don't know the right price for oil. Right. What I do know is that the incredible degrees of confidence that people were expressing around the fact that global demand for oil could never fall. And, you know, that when China reopened, we were going to see, you know, the prices explode to the top side. That's now beginning to turn very much to the, well, OPEC is not going to produce into these conditions, right? Again, you know, I would argue that components of OPEC's control could be perceived as much more fragile than the market generally looks at it, right? I don't see MBS, for example, as a particularly strong leader. I don't see Putin as particularly well-placed under this current framework either. So we just genuinely don't know how this is going to play out. In that situation, you want to use strategies like trend following to try to figure out what is the right price. Let the market guide you in that direction and don't pretend to have all the answers under that type of framework, right? So increasingly, I'm relying on strategies like trend following to give me an answer to that uncertainty. So that would be one of the things that I would highlight. The second thing that I guess I would highlight for people is that if I think about interest rates in a slightly different framework, and instead of thinking about interest rates as simply being, particularly interest rates that are set by a central bank, you know, as being set to try to drive monetary policy and instead being used to effectively drive fiscal policy, it actually starts to take on a more interesting framework. One of the things that I alluded to before, I think is actually increasingly true, which is the uncertainty around financing costs suggests that the current level of interest rates is probably too high, meaning, you know, fixed income products actually become somewhat interesting. But at the same time, the second component that I would highlight is if I can get 4 or 5% from a US Treasury bond, then suddenly I need to actually much more critically evaluate any other expenditure that I make. Right now, does that mean that it's the same as the 15, 16, 17, 20% levels that we had under Volcker? No, but also under Volcker, we had a much more robustly growing economy. We had population growth that was significantly higher. We had a global environment that was growing much, much, much more rapidly. And as you know, and I've shared this with enough people now that most people should know this, like the story that we tell around the 1970s is actually not a very good one, right? The 1970s were largely about massive population growth throughout the world. In particular, in the developed world, we saw an incredible amount of growth amongst those who were recently graduating from school and wanted to enter the economy. So the demand for houses, the demand for cars, the demand for homes were just off the charts. We had more jobs created in the 1970s, despite the tag of stagflation, than we have in any decade since. So the concern I guess I have around looking at interest rates and the way that they are is one, we shouldn't use a trailing inflation number. Two, we should broadly recognize that interest rates look really attractive. Again, Alex and I are very aligned on this. But the third component that I would highlight about high interest rate policy, and more accurately, volatile interest rate policy, is it reduces the private sector's ability to make decisions. And it increasingly guides you into frameworks where you have to ask, what does the government actually want me to do? Right. And so that can mean everything ranging from, you know, a focus on rebuilding the US, this dynamic of onshoring. What are the hurdles going to be that are put up against almost every other use of capital when the US is capable of basically saying, okay, we're going to charge we're going to offer people 4% risk free. And if you do what we tell you to, if you build the facilities that we want you to, we're going to offer you subsidized access to capital, right? That's really what I think Russell Napier is highlighting, for example.
Let's talk about U.S. Treasuries specifically, because as I just consider all of the possibilities here, it seems to me like one argument would be if you assume that the U.S. is going to maintain control over the Treasury market, they've already taken rates pretty high compared to what we could probably afford in terms of servicing the national debt. Alex Gurevich, whose views you seem to agree with on many fronts, thinks that those rates are going dramatically lower. That seems to be kind of a generational buying opportunity for treasuries, because especially if you buy duration, buy the 30-year treasuries, you can make that 5% holding to maturity. But more importantly, you can make 20% in the next couple of years if you see those rates come dramatically back down. On the other hand, you've also said that this is a war that's not with Iraq or Afghanistan. We're talking about China and Russia, very, very well-armed and powerful nations. If the U.S. starts to be perceived as losing that war to the point that U.S. treasuries are no longer considered to be the safe haven asset that everybody moves to in a safety trade, and you see an uncontrolled sell-off in U.S. treasuries, then you could have, a collapse scenario where it's a self-reinforcing vicious cycle, and you see a collapse of treasuries. So how do I think about, are treasuries an incredible bargain right now, as Alex seems to have suggested, or are they potentially a big risk trap?
I think, unfortunately, they're both, right? And that to me is part of what makes investing at this point in time so interesting. Again, just like commodities, I can't tell you what exactly the right price for treasuries is. As you articulated, the current level of interest rates is too high for the US government to really be self-funding. Right? We're unable to be able to survive at this level of interest rate. With very few exceptions, when that's been the case, you have not seen governments choose self-immolation. They have chosen to make themselves solvent. That would just involve cutting interest rates in the United States, right, on a policy basis. To the extent that we can increasingly become autarkic, that we can produce our food internally, that we can produce our energy internally, or that we're forced to do so for our trading partners, underpins our currency in a way that I would argue is largely the explanatory power behind why the dollar has been so strong, right? As the dollar has gained strength, you've seen the current account deficits, the trade deficits of Japan and Europe just explode as they increasingly are reliant on the US to provide them with very basic goods. I don't see any reason why that's going to turn around in any short order. And until, you know, and this is kind of the exciting part, right? Until the choices are made to radically restructure our energy systems. And to me, that, you know, that hits on many of the themes that other guests have talked about, things like nuclear, et cetera. The simple reality is that we have to move in that direction on a global basis. We're just not ready to embrace it yet.
Now, I have to believe the gold bugs listening are going to say that gold is the answer to everything, because you're talking about a degree of uncertainty that gold is a perfect hedge for. The counter argument would be, look, gold used to be the perfect hedge in different times. These days, gold's just shiny metal. It doesn't make any sense. How do you see this? Is gold a place we should really be thinking about investing here?
Well, so I would argue that gold has, you know, a combination of really interesting properties and also an underappreciated failing. If you think about the historical model in which gold was pegged, or the dollar was pegged to gold, right? Anytime you entered into a secular or structural inflation, as we experienced in the 1970s, for example, or even a debt crisis, as we experienced in the 1930s, where we were going to default against that and therefore needed to devalue the dollar. If you just think about the payoff structure there, it's incredibly one way, right? There's an incredible right skew to that dynamic, where overnight the treasury can devalue the dollar, leading to a 60% appreciation of gold, right? That right skew characteristic has unique properties in hedging a portfolio. The problem is that it no longer has that characteristic, right? There is no scenario in which the US government could wake up one day and say, okay, we're going to devalue the dollar against gold. You know, various claims to the opposite. Like, sure, they could wake up and they could print like mad on a particular day. That's likely to be occurring in a time period in which the credit system is collapsing. So your ability to exploit that through gold is going to be somewhat limited. But the underlying feature of gold having that extreme right tail movement is unlikely to be materialized under the current framework, right? It has much more to do with a slow, methodical grind, where you're effectively describing it as, you know, I think gold is going to gain against the S&P, for example, over a period of time. That's just a very different investment than betting against a pegged currency, right? If you want to bet against the Hong Kong dollar breaking, that has very different characteristics than betting that the S&P is going to go up. And its role in a portfolio is quite different. That's my only complaint against the gold dynamics, right? I think that there tends to be a fundamental misunderstanding of what happened when we depegged versus gold. It lost a lot of those portfolio hedge components to it. And by the way, nobody really actually experienced it in the United States, because before those devaluations occurred, gold was made illegal to own, right? So from an institutional standpoint, that has its own unique challenges. Where I would argue we've seen some interesting dynamics happening in gold is you have seen some signs that the dollar strength got ahead of itself, and we've seen a remarkable reversal in the dollar. You know, one of the fun things I did in preparation for this was go back and listen to several episodes. And if you just go back a month ago, you know, there was zero contemplation of the idea that the dollar could fall below 110, much less be in the 106 range where it's been recently, right? So we've seen really sharp moves in the currency space. And by and large, that's been echoed in gold. It also has helped that crypto world has, you know, blown apart and taken away a competitor to gold. So all of those are a very long-winded way of saying, I think that, you know, there are reasons to look at the uncertainty that we face and what you correctly describe as a bimodal outcome. We are kind of risking everything to put China back into a place where it no longer threatens us. That could work out very badly for us. It also could lock in another century of, you know, another American century. And, you know, I realize I'm speaking my book both as an American and as an investor. I have to place odds on us in this scenario.
You mentioned nuclear a few minutes ago. I want to come back to that because on one hand, it seems to me, I'm convinced that we have a major energy crisis, regardless of the whole carbon question of whether we need to eliminate fossil fuels for the sake of climate change. We're going to have to replace fossil fuels because Hubbert's Peak is real. Even Dan Yergin, the biggest critic, public critic of peak oil theory back in the early 2000s, was quick to acknowledge that they had the right idea. He just said it wasn't going to be till the 2030s that it actually became a factor. Well, the 2030s are just around the corner now. We're going to have to replace fossil fuels no matter what. It seems pretty clear to me that the way this is going to happen is we're going to avoid nuclear because of its political difficulty of people accepting it until there's no choice. And then all of a sudden, it's going to be the only choice. And if you think about that as an investor in free markets, you think, boy, I got to just go head first into as much physical uranium trust shares as I can possibly get my hands on. But then I think, wait a minute, you're describing potentially an outcome that sounds very much like World War II, where the government says, look, whatever amount of uranium we need in order to nuclearize the American energy grid, we're going to take at a price that we dictate. We'll tell you how much we're going to pay, and you won't have a choice. We'll do it under the, I forget what it's called, Defense Acquisition Act or something.
Right, Defense Appropriations Act.
So should we be thinking about something like physical uranium investments as an incredibly ripe speculation, or is it actually a speculation that's wrought with problems because by the time we really need it, maybe it's not going to be free markets that determine the price?
Well, unfortunately, I don't think it's going to be free markets that determine the price. The question is just, you know, is the price that is determined under that effective eminent domain framework, is that still a very attractive price, right? My bias would be yes, that it still makes sense. I think the bigger question is what it really means to have an energy crisis, right? So in the Western context, again, that means a shift in relative prices, right? I am less capable of getting XYZ because I need to pay more for my energy. At the same time, we use a lot of energy very inefficiently, right? We saw that in the pandemic where everybody is suddenly at home with a car and we realize that we want to run out for very short, you know, trips to the grocery store as compared to what used to be a weekend shopping excursion, right? Where you'd go buy a week's worth of groceries. Suddenly we were buying, you know, days worth of groceries and experimenting. I drive my wife crazy with that behavior, by the way. So when you think about that type of dynamic and that ability to shift our behaviors, I think people tend to underappreciate how innovative people can be in response to that. You see this in Europe, right, where people have functionally taken the Jimmy Carter approach. Okay, let's turn down the heat and let's put on a sweater. And yes, we're very fortunate that we got warmer than normal weather. But guess what? We're able to meaningfully reduce our energy consumption. Right now, is it sustainable? Probably not, but not because of the sweater component, but much more as you know, people like Doomberg and others have highlighted, because of the industrial base deterioration, right? You cannot run an industrial base in which you are that disadvantaged versus the US. But on a short-term basis, like that is the innovation that occurs. And some of that is going to be remarkable and wonderful, right? High gasoline prices will lead to much more efficient internal combustion engines and much more efficient hybrid vehicles and eventually to electric power or to fuel cell vehicles, et cetera. We're starting to see that play out already. And I know people are going to scream into the phone saying, there's not enough copper or nickel or heavy metals to make every vehicle electric. Again, it becomes a question of what is the innovation that occurs, right? I don't have to solve those problems. That's the wonderful part about a market-based system is somebody else has the incentive to go out and make very modest improvements. And those modest improvements eventually accumulate into radical change.
Our listeners have heard me talk ad nauseum about the energy crisis that I'm convinced is coming. And I've said that China reopening is going to be the big catalyst that brings it on. First part of the question is, do you agree with that view generally? And if not, why not? But the second part, since you've got so much insight into this new war cycle, is why do you think China has been so slow to reopen? A lot of us think there's probably more to it than just the advertised reason of, you know, concern about COVID. What's really going on behind the scenes is why, and why has China been so slow to reopen their economy?
Well, again, first, when you say I have so much insight, like, I just want to be very clear, like, these are opinions that have been derived from the facts as I see them, with very little unique information that I would, you know, either declare I have the ability to share, or if I had that, the willingness to share it. So I just want to caution everybody that this is what I'm seeing and the way I see the game unfolding.
Well, you called the war cycle before anybody I know by a year or two, so I'm still listening very intently, Mike.
I appreciate that, but again, I just want to be very, very clear that, like, you know, I'm not on speed dial with Joe Biden, and I'm fairly certain if I was, he would have already forgotten which number that was. So, you know, I just want to be really, really clear on that. My take on China, and I've argued this for a while now, is that China operated under a very simple principle. You don't protest, we'll make you rich. And the minute you can no longer make people rich, you can't actually rely on that. And so you have to stop them from protesting in a different way. To me, what's transpiring in China is a very simple reflection of what is called the political J curve, right? Where you migrate to stability. There's really only two places of stability. You either have an incredibly successful society in which people are broadly so happy that nobody really wants to get particularly worked up and disrupt it. With some exceptions, that's the United States. The second form of incredible stability is effectively North Korea. And so China, while we had hoped that they were going to migrate towards us, instead is very clearly migrating back towards North Korea. They're locking down their economy. They're locking down their citizens. Their citizens' ability to travel around the world or to accept foreign visitors who have any link to China other than already significant investments in the form of, you know, factories and invested capital that they can no longer get out of China and therefore have an incentive to toe the line. You know, those are the only people allowed in and out anymore, right? And I can't see how that unwinds. I don't see how you suddenly wake up and say to the Chinese people, you know, yes, we've been the best country at handling COVID. And by the way, would you really like to take a discounted flight to the United States so that you can see all the misinformation that they're going to share with you about how bad it was in China compared to the rest of the world, right? Or how much longer we kept you in lockdown? They just can't do that, right? It's the same thing as the Soviet Union in the 1950s, 60s, 70s. Where they effectively had to use the truth, right? Pravda means the truth, to spread absolute misinformation amongst their own population. And it seems like that's the path that exists in China today. That it's far more important that we view this as a political framework than we view this as a disease framework.
Mike, in the last few weeks, there's been a fair amount of confusion in the West about how to interpret certain signals coming out of China. There was first a report that someone who seemed to be pretty well in the know said that a committee had been formed, headed up by a senior person in the CCP, to plan the reopening of the Chinese economy. And there was a rumor that maybe they were targeting March for a full reopening. Then a weekend prior to last, that would have been 5th or 6th of November, Bloomberg reported that hopes had been dashed because China had reaffirmed its commitment. And it was in a speech that I think she gave on the 5th of November, saying that they were completely committed to their COVID zero policies. Bloomberg interpreted that to mean that they were disavowing or denying the reopening rumors. But I don't personally see it that way. I think they were just trying to save face on their COVID zero policies. Subsequent to that, The next thing that happened was there was an easing of border restrictions. So they've reduced the quarantines. They've eliminated the double quarantine. If you went to one city in China and then moved to another city, you used to have to do another quarantine. That's been eliminated. It seems like there is a trend toward at least beginning to ease some of the COVID zero policies, despite the fact that the official policy statement is to reaffirm their complete commitment to them. I'm interpreting this as something is afoot. They are moving toward a reopening, but that seems to be a minority view. How do you see it?
Well, I think it just depends on how you want to define reopening, right? So is reopening going back to a world in which Confucius Institutes are all over the United States and Chinese students regularly attend school, particularly, you know, graduate school in the United States, with very few limitations? Of course not. Like, we're not reopening back to that world. But are we reopening for business purposes? Probably, right? I mean, it feels like that's a reasonable expectation that at some point China is going to allow Westerners back into China to check on their factories, to check on their investments, to share their expertise, to, you know, engage in various behavior, and likewise allow those who are good and loyal party members to travel abroad and check on their investments in the same way that, you know, the Soviet Union was quote unquote open, right? And you were able to travel if you were a Soviet athlete. You just traveled with a handler, right, who made sure that you didn't defect. I don't see why China has to reopen in a free and open way. It can just begin to travel again, right? It can open up for business again, with Westerners really not going there very often, and the reverse, right? And the only Westerners allowed in are those who are already effectively captured because of the amount that they've invested in the country that they'd otherwise have to write off, right? I mean, there's almost no circumstance that, barring the actual escalation into open war, that Tim Cook is going to speak unfavorably about China, because he understands that as a CEO of a large American multinational, he places the assets of Apple at tremendous risk if he speaks openly.
I'm talking specifically about reopening in the context of resuming their industrial production and therefore consuming energy, particularly crude oil, the way they used to.
Well, again, you know, a huge chunk of crude oil is used for transportation. And when I think about it, in particular things like jet travel, et cetera, like, I just don't expect hordes of Chinese tourists to be traveling around the world again. I just don't think that's ever coming back, at least not until, you know, this quote unquote war is settled and we've decided who gets to rule the globe. Like that I would argue is kind of the thing, you know. This whole theory of deglobalization kind of makes sense when you can actually say to people, you'll never really understand or experience anything that's going on around the world. But in a world in which telecommunications or physical jet travel make it possible for us to circumnavigate the globe in, you know, give or take 25 hours or instantaneously over Zoom, the idea of true deglobalization to me feels almost impossible to imagine. What we really have is the need to resolve whose methodology or whose viewpoint is ultimately going to prevail. We either need to decide that we can accept the fact that we have radically different political frameworks and radically different outlooks on life that unfortunately are truly at odds with each other, right? You cannot have a totalitarian Marxist framework up against a capitalist, however, you know, captured you want to believe that system is. They actually can't exist in harmony. Right, because by definition, they're fighting over resources.
Mike, we've had a fair amount of gloomy-doomy discussion here. Something I've really learned from studying Neil Howe's work on the fourth turning is you have to understand that this is a necessary part of a long-term historical cycle. And one of the aspects of fourth turnings is it always sucks to live through them. But the upside is they always pave the way toward a better future. So let's end today's interview on a positive note. What are the things that we can look forward to from the perspective of these changes, maybe paving the way toward a better future?
Well, I think unfortunately that's exactly correct. And it's ironic. You know, I just wrote a piece for Barry Weiss about the Sam Bankman-Fried and FTX saga. And one of the things that jumped out at me was a very Neil Howe type observation, which is, you know, Sam Bankman-Fried has articulated that he's a Benthamite, right? A follower of Jeremy Bentham, or utilitarianism, which I've summarized elsewhere in the crudest form is the ends justify the means, right? This is the framework that Howe highlights as the true believers who are certain that they have the solution to the world's problems are currently rising to a position of power. It's one of the reasons why I'm relatively comfortable to say that we're experiencing a form of conflict that is much deeper than most people have acknowledged at this point, right? You genuinely have people in both the West and in the East who are convinced that they have the unique solution in a form that is a religious fervor, right? Think of the excitement of a Walt Whitman or a firebrand abolitionist in the U.S. in the 19th century and the fracturing that led to in the U.S. population. We're working through a lot of those problems in a very similar framework, and often those problems are really tied to exactly what you've highlighted, which is energy crises, right? We've moved from an environment in which we had unlimited amounts of energy relative to what we would have historically expected to one where we're suddenly forced to say, do I really want to make that additional trip? The stuff that excites me is actually the innovative solutions that will emerge to that, right? So the conditions of want and the conditions of higher prices that are signaled in a free market system tell us that we need to make investments both in the production of energy, which is where I would argue that far too many people are uniquely focused, right? They're just saying, you know, we need more energy, and also very focused, but you also need to focus on the idea of various ways of using less, right? And so everything ranging from 3D printing and additive manufacturing technologies to automated cars to reduced need for transport for a variety of reasons, the onshoring capability of the U.S. economy as we effectively do with manufacturing what we did with agriculture, which is remove the labor content of it dramatically. I absolutely see those happening in the next 15 to 20 years. It's not going to be painless. It's not going to be fun in a lot of ways. But on the flip side of that is a world that has, from our perspective today, infinite energy and infinite products and services relative to the what I think most people would have a hard time imagining is the scarcity of today. But the simple reality is the scarcity of today is identical to the surplus that we would have experienced in the 19th century relative to our forebears. We'll look back on the early 20th century as a period of suffering and want because people weren't able to get everything they wanted delivered to them at exactly that point in time. So I actually look forward to a lot of the innovative and, you know, to steal from Kathy Wood, and it makes me somewhat want to throw up in my mouth to repeat these things. But, you know, there is truly disruptive technology that is underway in everything from desalinization to manufacturing technologies to artificial intelligence, et cetera. And if we harness them properly, our children will have much better futures than we have.
Well, Mike, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. And what I always say at this point is before I let you go, tell me what you do at Simplify Asset Management. I feel like I'm kind of setting you up, though, because I know what you do at Simplify Asset Management, which is to manage ETFs, including a macro ETF, which seems like a great fit here. But I just feel an obligation to our listeners to point out, you did tell me earlier that you really think the trend following strategy is the way to play this. Trend following is generally only available through commodity trading advisors that are licensed by the CFTC and not through ETFs, but through fund structures that are only available to accredited investors. So I hate to set you up this way, but what do we do with an ETF guy in a world where you think, by your own admission, CTAs are the way to play this?
Well, so that's actually part of the reason why I joined Simplify, was that there have been a series of rule changes. In particular, in September of 2020, there was a rule change called the derivative rule as it related to ETFs. This allows ETF strategies to incorporate everything from derivative components to futures, et cetera. And trend following is now actually available within the ETF framework. We offer a product. I encourage people to check out our website to review that product. Others, do the same. So there are several choices out there. They are priced at a fraction of the cost of traditional commodity trading advisors. And in many situations, I think you'll find the performance is actually quite powerful. The strategies we run, we've built them for liquidity within the US market, specifically selecting products that complement equity portfolios. We recognize that most investors will have an underlying portfolio with a high degree of equities. So we exclude equities from our trend following strategies so that people don't become overexposed to equities in that framework. But we include everything ranging from interest rates to commodities to energy components, et cetera. And we'll be continuing to expand those products. We've built the back office and the capability so that we trade those and rebalance them on a daily basis so that you're not dealing with stale trend following strategies, which others struggle with. And so I'm really excited about that space. I think this is actually one of the areas where real opportunity exists. And you mentioned the macro portfolio. That macro portfolio in part reflects the allocations to strategies like trend following that I think increasingly have to take an important role when you have this degree of uncertainty as to what the world looks like next. Again, I don't know what the right prices are for many of these things. I'm going to let the market try to guide me to them.
You said something very important there that I wasn't aware of about a regulatory change. I was a CTA and managed commodity pool operator myself. I closed my fund in 2018, but as of my knowledge, which predates 2020, the problem was ETFs were not allowed to commit any more than 5% of their capital to margin on commodity trades, period. And the only way around that was you had to be restricted to accredited investors in a managed commodity pool. Are you saying that's changed? And if so, what's the ticker for your product in that space?
So those rules have changed. They've changed quite significantly. There are structural frameworks around how to build these products that have limitations in terms of the degree of volatility, the degree of concentration, et cetera, much more in common with traditional 40 Act components, just adding in products like futures. You have to be careful about the way you treat them. You do have to build up full ISDAs. You have to put in place organizational back office components that allow you to make sure that the taxes are handled appropriately, et cetera. And that for me has been the exciting part about working with the team at Simplify, because they're about as good as anyone I've seen at doing this stuff. The team is very experienced in the ETF space. The simple answer is almost anything that can be done within a CTA can now be done within an ETF. It's the real limitation that you have is the daily liquidity and market liquidity of intraday transactions. We work really hard to make sure that the product remains liquid and only focuses on products in which we can transact in size and do so during US market hours. But other than that, you're going to find almost no differences today.
Mike, that's fantastic news for retail investors. What is the ticker symbol for your product in the commodity trend following space?
The ticker is ironically CTA, as in commodity trading advisor. Again, you know, the team is fantastic at picking out names of products, and I would encourage people to check it out on our website.
Patrick Ceresna, Nick Galarnik, and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this. After being completely sold out of advertising space for the last couple of years, we finally have capacity to add a new advertiser. Macro Voices has a Podtrac certified global audience of over 170,000 listeners, and each weekly episode typically gets 60,000 to 80,000 downloads. We have more than 20,000 accredited investors who have registered with us as accredited, and we estimate the total accredited investor audience as at least 40,000 accredited listeners, which we believe to be the highest number of accredited investor listeners of any podcast on the internet. We strive to accept tasteful advertising from advertisers whose product is likely to appeal to our audience. So we're looking for another investment or financial services advertiser to fill the space I'm speaking in right now. If your company wants to advertise on Macro Voices, please email sponsorship@macrovoices.com for more information. Now let's get right back to the show.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Mike back on the show. Now, joining us again in the post-game segment is Nick Galarnik. Now, Eric, before we get to those charts, what did you take away from the interview with Mike Green?
Well, Patrick, it really hits me that this is another super smart guy questioning the secular inflation thesis that I was, frankly, pretty darn sure of and that I've been basing a lot of my worldview and investment strategy on. So it really causes me to take pause. Now we've had Jeff Snyder, Alex Gurevich, and now Mike Green all making different versions of what I'll summarize as an argument that the price inflation is likely to continue, but it would be a mistake to mistake that price inflation for monetary inflation. It's not monetary inflation that's causing the price rises. It's other factors causing the price rises. And if you assume it's monetary inflation and assume that the things associated with monetary inflation are going to continue, that could be a big mistake. I still wonder if it really is monetary inflation. That's been my thesis. But these are three super smart guys that are encouraging me to pause and reconsider that view. So that's exactly what I'm doing. The other thing is the first time in the history of Macro Voices that I actually learned something from the promo at the end. I wasn't aware that they had finally changed these stupid rules that prevent the investments that are available to normal people from investing in the best investment strategies. It used to be that only accredited investors could access commodity trend following strategies because they were only available through regulated products whose regulation required that they could only be offered to accredited investors. So I think that's fantastic news. I was completely unaware of that, and I need to do my homework and find out what else changed after I got out of the business of running other people's money.
Yeah, Eric, I have to agree that the debate on inflation versus deflation, I think also has to do with this idea of whether or not that deflation is going to be asset price driven, and inflation that is in food and energy and other things like this could actually continue. It's some of the bigger puzzle pieces that we should continue to talk about on the show. Now, let's get on to our chart deck. Listeners, you'll find the download link for the post-game chart deck in your research roundup email. If you don't have a research roundup email, that means you're not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, and click on the red button over Mike Green's picture that says looking for the downloads. Now, Nick, great to have you back on the show here, buddy. Let's talk some of these charts. On page two, I started by putting the S&P 500, and I wanted to look at some of these levels. But what are you watching in terms of the open interest and activity out there?
Yeah, Patrick. Well, right now I'm looking at the SPX spot, which is 39.15, November 18th OPEX, which is tomorrow. Currently, the expected move is pricing in about a 1.5% move in either direction, about 60 points. The upper expected move is about 39.75. Again, resistance there is around 4,000. This past week, we hit that about three times and rejected every time. So I expect to move lower here. Now, lower expected move for tomorrow is 38.55 and supports around 3,800 right there. Now, Eric, what do you think about the S&P here?
Well, as I've said before, my only strong conviction is medium to longer term in the sense that I don't think the final bottom is in, and I still think there's plenty of bad news to come for both markets and the global economy. In terms of here and now, the chart looks to be rolling over or at least taking a pause before tackling round number resistance at 4,000 on the S&P. So I do think we're at a short-term fork in the road and that it makes sense to expect the market to either fail here or break higher through 4,000 and then at least test the 200-day moving average at 4071 if it does break above 4,000. But whether it's going to break above 4,000 or fail below 4,000, frankly, I don't have any strong view.
Yeah, Eric, it's interesting because I am looking at similar levels. So on the chart, I marked with a red line that 4,000 level, and I conveniently also put the 3,900 level on there, which is where very close to where Fib retracements on hourly charts all lie. And in my mind, the S&P coming to this 4,000 level, which is where the Fib zones are, and like you're saying, the 200-day moving average is sitting right above there. We're all overdue for just the rally to be checked. But I don't want to already start to think bearishly about this. While I do believe we're in a bigger bear market, and we'll talk about it on the next chart, I don't see any reason why November is going to be where something more ominous would start. And so my first way of approaching this market is that while we can easily get to 3850 or 3900 during this little pullback, the initial dip should be bought by participants, and we could easily be heading right up towards, well, conveniently, that 4,071 level where you were just talking about that moving averages in there. I wouldn't be surprised if we would be in the first or second week of December still muddling along this 4,000 level above and below, and that a bigger move of conviction is going to have to probably wait for the new year. And that's where on page four, I wanted to just segue to the weekly version of this S&P chart. And really what I wanted to highlight was that for all of the bearishness, fine, there was huge carnage in the tech industry and many of those FANG stocks, and there was certainly carnage in the bond markets. But when you put it into a bigger picture context, we barely gave back 50% of the rally from 2020 up to 2021. We saw a more than 100% rise in the S&P that went 2,600 S&P points. And so while this bear market has been a challenge, it's hard to call this a bear market yet when all we've done is given back half of the previous couple years of gains. And this is where the bigger question I think to solve in the coming new year is that, is there another leg of a bear market coming? And that is one of the puzzle pieces that we're a big picture trading trying to solve. On page three, just skipping back a little bit here, though, I have the NASDAQ, and I wanted to just briefly touch on this because, to me, obviously there was a big snap higher in many of the FANG stocks, and some of the different semiconductors moved nicely. But overall, the NASDAQ has been and continues to be an underperformer on a relative basis. There continues to be a lot of distribution in this space. And for me, I don't see a reason why NASDAQ should come back as leadership in this cycle. And so while some people are getting attracted back to many of the traditional names that worked so well in the previous decade, like those FANG stocks, I think it's very likely that we're going to see a period where other sectors are going to continue to lead. Nonetheless, I think that the NASDAQ is going to have a very hard time beating that kind of 12,000 to 12,500 zone in the coming month. Now, Nick, I know you track the QQQs because that's where all the big options activity is. But what levels are you keeping an eye on there?
Yeah, Patrick. So as you were saying, you know, we've had many rallies this year, small rallies. And the largest one we had was about 24% on Qs from the June lows all the way to the August highs in the summertime. We've had a few subsequent rallies of about 7%, 7%, 12%, and most recently, 13% or so. And each time we've sold off these levels. So looking at the triple Qs, because they have more liquidity in the options there, resistance is around 290 right now. For tomorrow's OPEX, November 18th, current spot 282. Expected move is about 6 points or 2.1%. Upper expected move is 288. And lower expected move is 276 or so. Keep in mind, we have gaps above at 310-ish and a gap below at 263. So be very cautious here because we've seen these rallies occur only to be sold off very, very fast. And as I speak today, we're already dipping a little bit this morning. So I expect a lot more volatility. And
Nick, the one thing that, just to cut you off here, buddy, the one thing that I agree with is that we've seen over the last 6 to 9 months, these very short-term rallies that give back immediately. While I get your point there, I just don't know know whether or not the whole market is ready for another round of selling just yet. And I'll be really curious whether it does sell off aggressively like you may suggest, or whether or not it's more of a trade range muddle for many weeks. Anyway, the one interesting thing though is that when we move on to volatility on page five, is that usually volatility contraction tends to be a good bullish tailwind for these markets. But it's interesting that the VIX has been incredibly stubborn around this 25 level. I mean, while we did have that little dip down below 25, it was very quick to get right back up here. And I was really thinking that during this kind of a rally sequence that we'd see volatility trade to the bottom end of its range, and it really has not. What do you make of this, and what levels are you watching on the VIX?
Well, yeah, Patrick, I've been watching the VIX for a while, and a key support level is around 20, and a key pivot level, I would say, is 25, where if we get above that, you want to be very cautious on a run toward 30, and below that, obviously, we're going to pull back toward 20. But right now, the put-to-call interest is 0.25, which denotes that there are roughly four calls being purchased per put being purchased on the VIX, which is overall betting on VIX picking up in the coming months. So I expect a push toward 30, but let's move on to the dollar on slide six. Eric, what are your thoughts here on the dollar?
Until last week, to my eye, the chart was showing a sideways consolidation between 110 and 114. Then last week, I said it looked like it was really developing a downsloping channel, but a shallowly downsloping channel. Well, this week, there's nothing shallow, and frankly, that channel was very clearly violated to the downside, confirming for the first time in my mind that the trend reversal really has occurred, at least in the short term. Now, I'm watching 104 on the Dixie, which is where the market found support in August, as the next support level. If that doesn't hold, and particularly if we break substantially lower, it would really confirm the trend reversal beyond any doubt on more of an intermediate to longer term basis. After 104, the next support level that I see would be the May lows around 101.
Yeah, Eric, you know what? That dollar move, the one thing I would observe here is, to me, we've been, or at least I've been quite adamant that a dollar pullback was inevitably going to come. This doesn't actually make me dollar bearish yet. I simply, you know, such an extraordinary advance in the US dollar over the course of the 2022 year, inevitably rallies get checked. What to me, though, has been the part that's I'm still trying to kind of sort out is the depth and magnitude. I mean, we're already 10 Dixie handles off of the top, and happened so rapidly. And the thing is that really, like the levels you're talking about, this kind of 104, 105, 106 level is just a stone throw away. And the bigger question is, will this correction ultimately be that? Will it be bought on dip? Will we start to see that the price level is being defended? Or is this actually something bigger? I'm not willing to stick my neck out that a major dollar top is in yet, but it's certainly the magnitude of this drop is certainly put a lot of question marks out there. Initially, a bounce here back to 108, 109 is actually a very typical reaction, and then it'll be really interesting to see how the dollar settles down for the rest of the year, and that's certainly something that we're watching.
Now, moving on to page seven, we have crude oil over here. What are your thoughts on this, Patrick?
Well, you know what? I'm actually quite surprised by just the lack of trend that has emerged in crude. And while we had some very bullish developing price action throughout the month of October, there was an even attempt for a big breakout attempt on crude back over there. And really since then, it just came right back into the pocket. And that doesn't make me bearish crude oil, but it certainly has lost a lot of the momentum it was trying to build throughout the previous month. It will certainly take a catalyst to really get some bullish momentum. I think the most important thing for bulls here is that they hold above those October highs and get the price back above 90 within a reasonable period of time. It's going to be an interesting feat to see whether they can pull it off. But at this stage, I think using even the $90 level simply as a pivot from which you kind of are moving from this neutral zone price action to a bull breakout is going to be a very clean round number to keep a close eye on. With that said, I wanted to move on to page 8 where we have that gold chart. Now, Eric, what are you watching on gold?
This rally has taken the market $170 or a little over that higher in just 8 sessions. And needless to say, that's incredibly encouraging for the bulls. It looks like we really have a sudden trend reversal and upside breakout that is now underway. But at the same time, we're way past overdue for at least some kind of technical pullback. And the slow stochastics are now rolling over from incredibly high levels, confirming that view. My best guess on what comes next is a pullback to about 1720, which is where the 100-day and 13-day moving averages are conveniently co-located. For those who are convinced that we're seeing a new uptrend, that would be the logical place to add to long positions. If that doesn't hold, 1693 looks like the next obvious support below that.
Yeah, Eric, I have to agree with you on some of those levels. For me, there was an extraordinary explosive rally, and no different than the sell-off in the dollar, which led to these kind of very similar breakouts in a lot of cross currencies, including the euro. And all of these are so on the short term overbought that they will do retracements. And I know you were talking about some of these levels in the 1700 area, and I think that that's where the gold pullback could arguably go. In fact, it would be quite bullish if the gold pullback could be held above 1725 or to the 1750 area. Overall, though, I continue to approach this, that this will offer a buy on dip. And so as gold comes down into this pocket, it's going to be one of those areas where I'm going to keep a very close eye on how things are playing out.
And moving on to page 9, we have Sprott Uranium with a big red candle down. Now, what do you think over here, Patrick?
Well, up until yesterday's breakdown, it was shaping up to being a characteristically typical consolidation flag that often would have a bullish breakout. The fact that we saw such huge technical damage and some very heavy selling yesterday below the 16 level has done some real technical damage, and it certainly takes all of the wind out of the sails of the bullish uranium market. Now, one day doesn't make a new downtrend. The bulls could make a miraculous recovery over the next couple of days and get this north of 16 again. But if this sell-off that started yesterday ends up having any follow-through and it continues to maintain the weak price, it basically derails almost all of the bullish price action we've seen since the summer. And it will put uranium back into a far more neutral and trade-ranged price action, which would be very disappointing for a lot of uranium bulls that have been waiting for this to break out. But nonetheless, Nick, I wanted to wrap today's session by just touching on the 10-year treasury yield. And obviously, we had this huge surge in interest rates and bonds. The last leg of selling since the summer has been one of the more vicious legs of this bear market decline. And we obviously saw interest rates hitting that 4.25 on the upside. We're now taking the pause. And what I've circled on these charts was simply the two consolidation, the consolidation in the summer, which was also coming off of a pretty oversold bond market as rates were ripping up towards 3.5% back then in June. And it led to a multi-month pause and correction in yields as the bond market took a breather. And right now, there's no reason to believe that this is any different. I mean, it certainly be quite a fundamental event on a macro scale if we suddenly saw some sort of disinflationary impulse drive bond markets to have something of a bigger rally. While there are certainly a number of pundits out there that are trying to make that call, but I think it's very early to be getting excited about bonds. I think that as we pull back to this 3.5% yield level, it's going to be a point where we'll really get some valuable information as to whether or not there's something more to this than just a correction. And that's certainly something that's on my mind.
Folks, if you enjoy Patrick's chart decks, you can get them every single day of the week with a free trial of Big Picture Trading. The details are on the last pages of the slide deck or go to bigpicturetrading.com. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy and a one-stop shop for all green energy investors. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, in this week's Research Roundup, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the chartbook we just discussed in the postgame, and a link to a number of articles that we found really interesting. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make this program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases, and also follow Patrick at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend, Patrick Serezna, and myself, thanks for listening and see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.